Shabri, it's so good to talk to you, and we've been writing for so long, and I just think it's wonderful that we can have this interview. So can you just start out by saying a little something about yourself that you'd want readers to know?
Sure, and yes, I absolutely agree. It is really nice to finally be able to speak to you freely. Describing myself can be a little difficult, but if I wanted anybody to really know anything about the person and the individual that I am, I'm a mom of four amazing children. I'm a woman of deep faith. I am trained as a paralegal, a peer recovery specialist, a horticulturist. I'm also an avid writer and reader. I am the very first Albert Woodfox Memorial Mini Freedom Library librarian. And I advocate for people inside, and I also am currently an incarcerated person, and I'm serving 30 years for a nonviolent offense as a first-time offender.
Wow, that's a lot. I think it's amazing what you've been able to do, and, you know, I've read so much of your writing, and you're such a good advocate, and were you writing before you were incarcerated?
I did. I had started to write my childhood because I was a foster child, and writing became a way for me to express myself. It was an outlet. When we're in those positions, it's much like being incarcerated, where there's not really anybody that is hearing your pain, that you're able to process those deep emotions with, and the outlets are really minimalized. So I found that that was a good way to express myself, and I found a lot of healing in it. A lot of my writing was actually cultivated and crafted in the places of my absolute worst pain. And then as I became a teenager, I started to realize the power of writing, especially the written communication form, and the power that it had to change a narrative. So as a foster kid, people saw me, right? And they see, you know, this child, they see the circumstances, they see the case file, but they never really see me. And what writing did is it exposed my soul, and it exposed me in a different kind of way, and it was so impactful with people because it contrasted what they thought I was, that literally my own writing rewrote the narrative of how other people defined me. That linked in to incarceration as well. It didn't just stay there. And I don't think that my experience in that is unique, because I think when people pick up their pen for the first time, when they're locked behind it, closed doors in a cage the size of a parking space, and the only thing that you have is an ink pen and a piece of paper, I think that you have to just let the guttural words that are screaming in your soul fall out onto the piece of paper. And it's a release, but it's also documenting the fact that this is happening to me. This is real life, and I am going through this, and this is a solid document saying that this is not my imagination, and this is what these people are doing, and this is how it's happening. So I think that it's a multifaceted thing. Being incarcerated definitely made me cultivate that skill. When you're trapped and that is your only way to communicate, it's huge. It's also your only way to fight back. Incarceration, in theory, is designed to be able to separate us from a community. And it's supposed to create a rehabilitative setting, again, in theory. But what it actually does is something entirely different, because it's power that goes predominantly unchecked. And when power goes unchecked, it becomes abusive. So the writing becomes a defense mechanism, right? So you learn policy, you learn what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And the same things that are used to draw boundaries for you can be used to draw safety lines for other people. So I definitely cultivated it there. And then I started to realize the healing power for other people. Not in just telling our truths and exposing what was here, letting light hit the darkest places of the prison, right? The darkest happenings. And being able to do that with the written word gave a power back to us, not necessarily to dominate, but just to be human again.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. And I get so many people that write to me and say, this is the first poem I've ever written, or this is the first time I put my thoughts to words. And in a way, a lot of people suggest and have said that it was frightening at first, because it was like you're making it out loud, right? You're saying it out loud when you commit to paper, right? Because you know that it's going to be read. And so for a lot of people, it was important to do it because they had to tell the truth about themselves.
absolutely. I think anytime, you know, incarceration offers the unique perspective on that, because when you're locked in a room and you've lived through the absolute worst moments of your life, you have to face your responsibility in the situation, right? That's definitely a thing. So you become accountable and you face your demons in the ugly places that people in the free world don't even slow down long enough to be able to face, because the pace is just so quick. And when you first become incarcerated, everything comes to a screeching halt. But then there's also the other factor, because you're put in a position, you know, when you originally get locked up, you think that, you know, it's a moral thing. It's about right and wrong. And that as long as you're good, then, you know, and you do what's asked of you and you don't break laws and you don't break rules, that, you know, you won't be bothered by things. And you get hit with the whiplash of the oppressiveness, the unfairness, the inconsistencies, and the flat-out abusiveness of the prison environment. And it's the rules change depending on who's on shift, right? And you never know who's who until you learn who's who. So I think that having to do that deep dig and then put it on paper is scary for a variety of reasons. Not only are you having to face yourself in a new kind of way, but when you expose anything out of prison, there's always the fear of retaliation. There was a time where my room got ran 13 times because I wrote a grievance, 13 times in a month. And I didn't do anything, and they never found anything, but it was punishment. And I mean, they got me, you know, early in the morning, in the middle of the night. And I literally had to escalate it all the way to the assistant warden just to make it stop. So
that's another kind of writing. Yeah, it's true, though.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah, and words are powerful, and for what, you know, right? Especially in those situations. But I think you also mentioned Mr. Airy as a catalyst for your writing. And can you talk a little bit about how that also impacted you as a writer and a person?
Absolutely. That is something that I don't know that I can even give enough words to describe the level of impact that Calvin has had on my life, and really countless others through the connection that I made with him. So to kind of adequately describe this, I have to go back to the beginning. I was actually in Fluvanna at the time, and I came across a Richmond Magazine article that featured him, and it was called Unbroken. And Calvin was a former prisoner at the Richmond Penitentiary. And in that, he and some other men that were incarcerated there were treated really poorly. And they filed lawsuits. They did a lot of different things that allow us to have rights today that we didn't have before. The Landman versus Royster case was huge in giving us our Prisoner's Bill of Rights, amongst other things. Many of those things, when I read his story, I realized that I actually exercise a lot of the things that I do without consequence because of what those men suffered and fought for. And for me, that alone was impactful. It was impactful enough that I had to reach out and I had to say thank you. So I didn't know him, and I wasn't really sure how to go about contacting a magazine or what even the appropriate way to do that was, but I was compelled to respond. So I had my daughter look up the address because it said that he was a realtor at some point, and I just penned a thank you letter. Well, Calvin wrote back, and when he wrote back, one of the things he asked me is if I had read a book called Our Class by Chris Hedges, and I had not. So he sent it to me. Now, this was during COVID, so what they did, they actually had a little chuck hole at the front of the wing, and it's, you know, the wings in Fluvanna are set up like fishbowls. The lights never go out. They want to be able to view you all the time. It's inconvenient for most reasons, but in this case, it was actually incredibly beneficial because everybody saw me get that book because it was COVID, and it got brought right to the wing, and they wanted to know what it was. So once I read it, somebody else read it, and somebody else read it. And it's incredibly powerful because it's about someone who taught in the prisons and how prisoners are not exactly what you would think they are. So from there, it became a lending thing. And we ended up lending different books to different places. And the Albert Wood Fox Memorial Mini Freedom Library was eventually born. It became a mutual aid thing, and it's caught on to several different prisons. But in that, I also learned a lot about what other people did in prison, because those books were incredibly powerful. They showed me not only that Calvin, you know, what he did, he shows he's proof positive that we're not the worst thing we ever did, which I think is a Bryan Stevenson quoted originally, but, you know, we're so much more than that initially.
Yeah.
the last couple of years, a lot of those credentials that I rattled off, or at least the pieces that I had said, I found and was able to do based on what I had read in those books. So I became a lot of other things, you know, being able to take classes as a horticulturist. I'm currently enrolled in college classes, which amplified my writing. I had a skill set, but it wasn't cultivated yet, and not being able to cultivate it was incredibly difficult. Once I cultivated it, Calvin started sharing it with people. I got feedback. I was interacting with people out there in the free world and that I probably never would have had access to. And what that did is it made me a real human being. So, you know, just having that exposure and being able to change the narrative of what we are inside is also incredibly impactful. But Calvin stayed every step along the way. He's uplifted with quotes. He's, you know, done everything that he could to encourage, to stay involved, to connect me to other people. I was able to write an article for Inquest based on that as well. So, you know, it's just an absolute... the level of impact is phenomenal. I cannot say enough good things about somebody like Calvin. People like him just normally don't exist. He's pretty positive, too, of the power of proximity. So when you get close to a problem and you can see where the need is, and by watching how he's done these things, I've learned myself. I've also seen what happens with prisoners because, you know, we're so quick to use the word prisoner. And in reality, prisoners are the people you see on TV, and it's the people that the prosecutors talk about. It's the boogeyman that they use for political agendas. Prisoners don't exist. Incarcerated people exist. And we are people, just like everybody else, with emotions. And, you know, a lot of us have just made one bad decision that, you know, turned the rest of our life. But we're still people that can be cultivated and that are capable of change. And Calvin lives that. He lives that truth in such a way that a lot of us emulate it. And we're honored that he reaches back in to even do anything at all for us. And that alone has such just a meaningful presence to it.
Yeah, Mr. Airy is a really amazing person. But I think you're right about narratives, especially about women. And one thing that people probably don't realize, but most women in prison are mothers.
Right.
And I think that writing is also a way to connect with, stay connected with their loved ones and their kids, but it also is like a different kind of expression. You know, it's not a phone conversation, right? You're telling different kinds of truths with your writing. How do you write to your kids?
Oh, in many ways. I both pin them and email to them. And you know, you raise kids in 20-minute intervals on the phone from prison, and it is the absolute worst part of incarceration. More than the abuse, more than the time, more than, you know, wanting the things that you want. Being separated from those that you love is a punishment of your soul. And it's not just because you want to be around them, it's because they suffer too. And so when you write them and you pick up that pen, you have to be able to bridge that gap. And to be able to, you know, a lot of us, we don't get to see our kids on a regular basis because there's distance or there's financial burden that make it, you know, the visits far and few between. I'm graced because I do get them sometimes, but there's a lot of people who don't get them at all. So the only way that they will ever hug their children is with their words. The only way that they can ever convey that they're proud of them is with their words. And it's important to do. I love that you mentioned the phone call versus the writing, because that's so pivotal, because writing is something tangible. I can tell you something and you hear it and you may forget or whatever the case may be, but writing is a record. It is a formalized documentation and it is something that is binding. My children can go back and read them. They tell me that they keep all of the letters that I send them. One of my sons has even made a little binder that he keeps every single thing that I have ever sent him down to the envelope. And for him, it's a reminder. And it's not just a reminder of, hey, my mom's in prison, but hey, my mom loves me. Hey, I'm valued. Hey, she cares. Because our family pulls the time with us. And even more so, you know, being inside, it keeps us grounded in a different kind of way because we still have a responsibility. Just because we're incarcerated doesn't mean that somebody else can just step in and take our place. We are still needed in our family's lives. And that not only gives us a sense of community, that's so pivotally important to our personhood, but it also helps them out as well because we've got to heal and bridge that gap. They didn't do anything, but they're pulling this time with us. And it's just, it's absolutely important for our communities, for the way that our children are being raised, for the people that are taking care of them, that we're able to be able to give them those things in writing. Especially being in prison, like if you're listening to this phone call, a lot of times I'm tripping up on my words because people are walking behind me and incessantly screaming. The echo is insane, the amount of noise, and I don't know how it's coming across in the phone, but it's often so loud, even on this phone call right behind me, that my thoughts get jumbled and I can't get my words all the way out. And in that, you know, your phone calls to your kids are affected the same way. And if people don't have the respect for those pieces because everybody's trapped in this tiny little spot, you know, and everybody's trying to get their words out, it's really, really, really difficult to be able to have that intimate moment where I can fish and start putting Band-Aids and applying balm on the wounds of my children. And also, I would say there are days where I can't call because there's a lockdown. There are times where I can't get to them because there's a phone line, because there's way less phones than there are inmates. The ratio.
You have 1 minute remaining.
It's absolutely painful.
And we got that 1 minute reminder just to remind us, right? Well, listen, Shabri, I think it's wonderful, this conversation we're having, and we'll be in touch soon, okay? I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.